Welcome to the first in a series on the research and publication of faculty and authors in the Augusta University community. My name is David Bulla. This is the Research Report. Today, our guest is Professor Debbie Van Tool, who teaches communication at Augusta University. Dr. Van Tool earned her PhD in journalism and mass communication from the University of South Carolina. And in 2019, she was the recipient of the Sidney Cobray Award from the American Journalism Historians Association. This is a Lifetime Achievement Award given to journalism historians, and this marks her as one of the great historians living today in the United States for the field of journalism. She's the author of at least 7 books and counting, including Knights of the Quill, which is about journalists during the Civil War in the South. Her latest book from Syracuse University Press, she is co-editor, is titled Politics, Culture, and the Irish-American Press, 1784 to 1963. And that's what we're here to talk about today, this book. I'd like to begin by asking Dr. Van Tool, what is transnational journalism and how is it different from international or global journalism?
So transnational journalism is different from international journalism in that international journalism sets up an us and them dialectic. Okay, so if I am a foreign correspondent for the United States covering Mexico, let's say I'm covering the building of the wall in Mexico. If I'm approaching it as an international journalist, I am writing about something that the United States is doing that's having an impact on Mexico, but I'm not really looking at how's it affecting the U.S. as in quite the same way. In a transnational situation, I'm saying, so this wall is being built to separate the U.S. and Mexico, but the story flows from Mexico into the United States. It also flows from the United States back into Mexico. And I'm going to cover it as a story that's affecting both countries and the people who live on either side of that wall or who try to get past the wall to get into the United States. So it is a broader story. It is a story where there are no us and them. There's only a we.
So it's kind of about a shared culture.
Yeah, or a shared experience anyway. I mean, there's probably some differences. Well, I know there are differences in Mexican culture and American culture that would affect the way we look at that story, particularly from an international perspective. But from a transnational perspective, that's where we kind of get rid of the borders, get rid of the culture, and we get it boiled down to the basic human element of the story.
How did you get started on this book idea? You just gave Mexico as an example, but this is about the Irish-American press. And what made you want to write about the Irish-American?
Okay, so those are kind of two different questions. The first one, I was at a conference probably, I think it was 2009, at Cardiff University in Wales. And it was a conference on the future of journalism. And I was there to talk about how the history of journalism might help us predict what the future of journalism would be. This is right after the 2008 crash when newspapers and media organizations across the world were just going bust, you know, one after the other. And one of the mantras in that was, we have no business model. And the purpose of what I was there to say is, we do have a business model. Let's look back to the 19th century, which is where most of my research is. Well, while I was there, someone caught my American accent. And I've had that happen to me 3 times when I've been in Great Britain. And 3 times I've had just really weird experiences as a result. And so when this person looked at me and said, you're American, I just kind of paused for a moment and said, yes. And he said, you're the ones who invented journalism. And I said, we did? When? Because we didn't invent journalism. Journalism existed long before the United States existed. Yes, some of it was practiced here before we were a country, but even so. And so that just got me interested in, at that point, what I was thinking of global perspectives on what is journalism, where does it come from, what's its history. And I started talking with a fellow there who was from Ireland. His name is Mark O'Brien. And I knew Mark from a conference I'd been to in Ireland. And we were both very interested in this other fellow, who I believe he was Romanian, if I'm remembering correctly, his perspective on America being the creator of journalism, because as someone who studies Irish journalism, which fits into the larger topic of British journalism, Mark was fully aware that the United States had nothing to do with the creation of journalism. Maybe we've produced some new forms along the way, but we didn't create it. So anyway, Mark and I had a long layover at the airport, and we just got talking. And the more we talked, the more we thought, there's something to this. And so for a couple of years after that, whenever I would travel to Ireland, he and I would meet for coffee in Dublin, and we would talk about, can we get a conference together on this? What's this idea? What is it? We know we're grasping at something, and we know it is something. We just don't know what it is yet, because this was a new idea. And we had decided to do two conferences, and one of them was to be in 2016, which was the 100th anniversary of the Irish nation. And we were hoping to have it in Ireland that year. It ended up being in the U.S. that year. We switched years. But anyway, around the end of 2014, I was just looking online for some material to use in a paper for the first conference in 2015. And I came across an article by this Dutch scholar by the name of Marcel Boersma. And it was basically a definition of what transnational journalism history is. And as I read that article, I said, this is it. This is exactly what Mark and I have been talking about. We just didn't have the word for it. And Marcel had kind of worked it all out, and he had 8 very elaborate categories. Continental scholars tend to be really detailed in the way they do things, and he had really done a fine job with that. I collapsed those categories into about 3, but at any rate, I said, this is it. And I sent that to Mark and said, this is what we're talking about. We have a name for it now, and this is the first article I can find that deals with it. Can we maybe get this fellow to be the keynote speaker when we do the conference in Ireland? So he knew Marcel. They had been to a couple of conferences before together in England at Sheffield University. And Mark got a hold of Marcel and invited him to be the keynote speaker when we had the conference in Dublin. Marcel came and did a great job. And he and his research institute at Groningen University in Groningen, the Netherlands, agreed to sign on as a co-sponsor of the conference. So I feel like we've got the absolute best team possible. We've got a continental European. We've got someone from I hate saying the British tradition, because he's Irish and the Irish wouldn't necessarily like that today, but the British tradition, which is, of course, the foundation of the American tradition. And that's really where the Irish-American connection comes from. Because as we were first looking at this, Mark and I were looking at the relationship between British, between literally Irish journalists and journalism and American journalism. Because if you go all the way back to the colonial period, the Irish were the largest immigrant group in the United States, really until nearly the end of the 19th century. So from the beginning to about the end of the 19th century. So that's about 150 years worth of Irish coming in. They were leaders in the Revolutionary War. They were leaders in American journalism. They led opposition. They led majority newspapers. They just were a huge part of the formation of the United States, and I would argue to American culture. And so Mark and I started looking at all the different contributions of American, to American journalism by Irish journalists. We said, this is what we need to focus on for that first conference. And so that was what the paper call on the first conference was really the Irish-American connection. And then to do this book, we recruited a few other authors to write other chapters. But it was just because that seemed like such a good starting point, given that he and I are the first two involved in this project.
Well, I wonder, could you define Irish journalism and American journalism, and then maybe where they kind of come together?
So if I'm thinking about Irish journalism, of course, I'm thinking about journalism that's practiced in Ireland by usually Irish people. I know there's a pretty prominent writer at the Irish Times named Henry Brown, or he goes by Harry, but his real name is Henry. He's a radical writer. He's from the United States. He's born in America, but he was born to Irish parents who had immigrated and was able to go back to Ireland. So he would be kind of an anomaly. But for the most part, we're talking about Irish-born Irish journalist working in Ireland versus American-born and American journalist working in the United States. Where we talk about Irish-American journalism, we're talking about journalism that is produced for those Irish Americans, or I'm sorry, for those Irish who come to America as immigrants, and then their children and grandchildren who then become Irish Americans. But we're looking at journalism that keeps the ties alive between Ireland and America for those people who are living in America but think of Ireland as home. So one of the newspapers that I worked with initially when I was starting to do this was run by a fellow by the name of Thomas Francis Marr. Thomas Francis Marr was a young man from Waterford, Ireland, who was one of the leaders in the Young Ireland Rebellion in 1848. He was exiled from Ireland as a result of running a revolution against the British, and he was exiled to Australia. He eventually escaped Australia and came to the United States and started a newspaper in New York. And that was one of the first Irish-American newspapers that I did any study of at all. He had a correspondent in virtually every county in Ireland who would write about what was going on in that county for every issue of his newspaper. So if you were living in New York and you were from County Monaghan, you would pick up his newspaper, which I believe was called the Irish News. See, it's been too long now since I wrote that paper. But anyway, you'd pick up Mar's newspaper and you'd go to where all the county correspondence was and you'd look down and you'd see what's going on in County Monaghan. And you'd find out that the harvest was pretty good this year, that there's a new priest in the parish, that this person had married that person, that this person had stolen that person's horse, you know, just your typical small town correspondence that those of us who have used to work in weekly newspapers would have seen in old-fashioned weekly newspapers. So you could get the news from home. He wrote about Irish politics because that was something that was important, as important to Irish living in America as American politics were, if not more important, because Ireland was home and home rule was one of the big issues at that point. And so that would have been one of the things that he wrote about a lot because he had some pretty strong feelings about that. He and Daniel O'Connell, who had been the main leader of the movement for home rule, had ended up on opposite sides of that issue. You know, O'Connell wanted a slow advance towards home rule, whereas Marr was the now, let's get it done now. And so, of course, you would have some back and forth between O'Connell and Marr in the newspaper. But it would have been the kind of newspaper that those Irish immigrants to New York would have bought in great numbers. And in fact, they did. He was very successful. The only reason his newspaper collapsed is he decided he wanted to go exploring down in Nicaragua. And so he wasn't there to run the newspaper. And the people he did have running it kind of got tired of doing it without him around. And it shuttered then right as the Civil War began because he becomes the commanding general of the Irish Brigade from New York. That was such an important unit for the North in that conflict.
Well, let's go back to the Revolution. Were quite a few interesting characters from that period of time who came over from Ireland, and they had a very interesting take on things because they tended to oppose the Federalists, who were led by John Adams, who were more pro-England, and whereas Thomas Jefferson tended to be more pro-French, and the Irish sort of, for complicated reasons, took more of the French side and things. And so it was a very interesting sort of triangular mess. But these fellows generally were the raucous political kinds of journalists that were, you know, really the mainstay of that period, right?
Oh, absolutely. I know you're very familiar with William Duane because that's your chapter in this book. Duane is one of my favorites. He actually is American born, but he was born to Irish parents in upstate New York. His father died when he was, I want to say, about 14, which was about the time the American Revolution was beginning, which for a 14-year-old boy, imagine how romantic that is to see a revolution beginning against this oppressor who had oppressed his parents' home country and forced his parents into immigrating to the United States. Well, to the American colonies, I suppose, as you call them at that point. His mother returned home to Ireland after his father died. I'm sure that had to do with family reasons and being able to support her son better at home. But Duane is fascinating because, in fact, he's one of my favorite journalists because I don't know of any other one that faced sedition charges in three countries, because he faced sedition charges in England, in India, and in the United States. And in the United States, it was more than once. Sedition, of course, at that point in time meant criticizing the government. And he worked for Benjamin Franklin Bosch, who had the newspaper, The Aurora, which was the leading opposition newspaper during the Adams administration. Bosch also was charged with sedition, but died of yellow fever before he could be charged. But I would say that from my reading of The Aurora before and after Duane took it over, Duane was much more radical than Bosch. And personally, I believe rightly so. I think the Federalists were wrong in some of their policy ideas. And John Adams is one of the people that my husband and I like to argue over. He likes Adams, and Adams is not one of my favorites, because Adams, of course, is behind the Alien and Sedition Acts. The Sedition Act was specifically targeted at journalists like Duane. Adams was afraid that in 1800, when he had to run for re-election, he would not be reelected because of the anti-federalist press, of which Duane was one of the leading journalists, and so he wanted to shut them up. The Alien Act was intended to make citizenship harder so that all these, this is a quote from a Pennsylvania congressman, all these hordes of wild Irishmen coming into the United States were getting citizenship in 5 years. Well, if Adams could slow down how quickly they became citizens, make it 14 years instead of 5 years, he didn't have to worry about them voting. And that was his purpose, was to keep people like Duane from getting citizenship and also to silence them. So Duane was only one of several Irish journalists, and there was one Scotsman in the mix as well. But John Daly Burke is another one. Now, he got in trouble with Adams and worked out a deal so that if he would return to Ireland, he would not be prosecuted for sedition. He didn't go back to Ireland. He was friends with Thomas Jefferson, so he went and hid out on Thomas Jefferson's plantation, Monticello, and then plied his career as a journalist for the rest of his life in Virginia. And then the third one, who I think is particularly important in this period we're talking about, is Matthew Carey. Now, by the time Adams became president, Carey had retired from the newspaper business, but he still was a very prominent pamphleteer and also bookseller. So he was writing pamphlets primarily about Irish politics and making parallels between things going on in the United States and Ireland and that sort of thing. So you had men who weren't afraid to go to jail or to get on the wrong side of the president, and who would stand up to them and to the president. And I really admire the journalists of that period, particularly the Irish ones who were so feisty. I think to some degree, one of the big influences that those journalists had was not just that they annoyed the president, but that because they weren't afraid of sedition, because they had faced sedition charges so often, they had some very strong feelings about freedom of the press that were expressed in their newspapers and talked about among Americans. And I think they helped water the seeds of, I don't want anyone controlling what I have to say, that were planted by earlier cases in the United States, such as the John Peter Zinger case from 1735 and others that would come along. So I think that it's because of them that did help Americans develop a distinct perspective on free speech, and that led us eventually to have the First Amendment in the Bill of Rights.
Well, I was wondering if there's a sort of a lesson from these journalists from the 18th century and early 19th century for journalists today.
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, Adams, in a sense, was accusing those journalists of being fake newsers, right? Of producing fake news, of lying. And they just said, whatever, and kept on. And they endured whatever Adams threw at them. Thomas Cooper, who was English, he wasn't Irish, but was probably the journalist who got the harshest punishment under a sedition prosecution. He ended up in jail for 6 months and had a $400 fine. Well, $400 doesn't sound like a lot today, but if you go back into 1798, 1799, I don't remember which of those years he was prosecuted in, but it would have been one of those two. $400 was tens of thousands of dollars. And he was just a poor journalist and college professor. He didn't have tens of thousands of dollars to pay out. His friends helped him raise it so he could get out of jail. But Cooper, all Cooper did was write a story in a paper about, if he were president, this is how he would approach certain policy issues. And that got him swept off to jail with this huge fine. I think journalists today could learn to be a little feistier than they are from journalists of that day. I mean, I read the New York Times, the Washington Post, although the Post isn't quite as whiny as the New York Times. But the Times is really starting to get on my nerves sometimes with all of their editorials about President Trump and how nasty he is to the press and all that. Well, that's the way it's supposed to work. We have an adversarial system. Embrace it. We're the watchdogs on government. And I think we could learn that if we knew more about journalists, we as a profession, that is, like Duane or Daly Burke or Cooper.
And Cooper also was a scientist, right? And the founder of University of South Carolina, right? Or first president.
First president, right. Of the University of South Carolina, absolutely. Yeah,
so there's a sort of a local connection with him.
And the main library there is named for him. I've spent many, 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 many hours doing work when I was doing my dissertation there in the Cooper Library.
Well, this is a book, and I know that for historians like yourself, it's kind of a labor of love, but it still has practical issues, and I'm wondering how an author in Ireland, an author in the Netherlands, and an author in Georgia in the United States sort of work through the process of making this book.
I think we were really fortunate to be doing this in the days of the internet, because between file sharing technology, the internet, email, it was actually fairly simple. I created a box folder and put all the chapters in, and labeled them with the drafts, and we all edited them. We collaborated on writing the introduction to the book and the conclusion, but we would write our part and put it in box, and the others would download it, write their part, and put it right back up. So if it weren't for the technology we have today, I don't know that it would have been as easy, because we would have had to rely on mail, and who knows what's going to happen to big packages, you know, of manuscripts that get mailed back and forth between three countries. But I think it was absolutely because of the technology that it was no harder. I'm editing a book right now with someone in New Mexico, and it was no harder to do it with the two guys overseas than it is with the person in New Mexico.
Were there any obstacles, though, to getting this all together and getting it together in a timely fashion to get it to the Syracuse people?
Oh, well, yes. The biggest obstacle was COVID. Just about the time that we were getting the contract signed, getting all the chapters in, and we're supposed to be getting everything to Syracuse University Press, who's publishing this, COVID hit. And as you know, New York just shut down. I guess, was it from March to like maybe June or so? And so even though Syracuse was not New York City, which is where the big hotspot was, the governor just shut the whole state down. And so there were not even any answers to emails if I had to email Syracuse University Press for something until June or July. So the book was supposed to be out in May, and it's still not out. And I know that is because the press is so far behind, because all the books that were supposed to be out over the summer are backed up too. So I'm not sure when we're actually going to see it, but I keep saying soon, because we turned in the final manuscript in the end of August, once they opened up fully again and could take the submissions. I think the index got to them the first week of September, and that was the last thing that had to come in. We've been victimized by COVID, but then so has everyone else, it seems.
Well, looking back on the making of this book, what's kind of your favorite part, or what's been your favorite experience in putting it all together?
I have to say my favorite part has been working with a scholar in Ireland and a scholar in Holland, and then all the scholars across the world who contributed to the book, who contributed chapters to the book. Because I feel like we have lived out what we're writing about. And that may sound kind of strange, but when you get down to the very bottom line of what scholarship is, even though Marcel approaches his scholarship as a continental scholar, and that's a little bit different in terms of the way they think about things than Americans. I think Americans are closer to the way we think about things with the Irish. I think our shared heritage through the British line gives us a much more similar perspective than someone in Holland, who's probably going to have something more in common with scholars in France or Germany or that sort of thing. So there were a couple of times that Mark and I kind of looked at each other quizzically, even if it was across the Atlantic Ocean, when Marcel would say something, and we would kind of email back and forth each other and say, "What do you think he means?" kind of thing. But I just love that we lived out that transnational experience, as that's what we were writing about, is that borders went away, differences went away. We were just three scholars. Well, and then you bring in all the chapter authors too, working on trying to figure out what something is. And it was just so rewarding and so exciting to be doing what I was writing about. Because usually as a historian, you're looking back somewhere in history and you're writing about what actors did, but you're not doing it alongside of them. And I felt like we were doing this alongside of the people we were writing about. And that was just really exciting to me. I know it sounds kind of nerdy, but I guess if you're a historian, you kind of fall in that category.
Well, I also think it shows that these three parts of the world, and I'm going to say that Britain is sort of, an extra part of Europe. Yeah. But here we have North America, the British Isles and Western Europe, and you know, you're putting together a description and an explanation of a particular phenomenon, journalism. And what you find out is there's a whole lot in common.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Marcel was working, when we first began this book, on a big grant from the Dutch government. And while he is a historian, he also runs a research institute that deals with modern media. And he had a big grant from the Dutch government to look at how is new media affecting our society. And so he could bring even that perspective of as the media has changed through the years, and this does start in the 18th century and goes through the 20th century, he could kind of bring his theoretical knowledge of how media changes, what leads to its changing, what are the effects of its changing, to his editing of those chapters. So it was a different way of informing what we were doing, and I think that strengthened the book. So I think absolutely, those different perspectives made everything better than it would have been if it had just been written from an American perspective or an Irish perspective or a Dutch perspective, for that matter.
Now, I know the conference, the Transnational Journalism Conference, was supposed to be here. And I guess, of course, COVID sort of caused it to be postponed. But is there an idea for another transnational book?
Yes. We actually have a contract with Routledge for the next book, which we'll have to start working on very soon now. I think they were both, they being Mark and Marcel, were waiting on this one to come out before we started on the other one. But I think we're going to have to go ahead and get started so we can meet our deadline. But it is part of a Routledge series called Companion to, and then fill in the blank what the blank is. And it's going to be Companion to Transnational Journalism History. It's going to have about 50 chapters in it, so it's going to be a big reference book. And Marcel's going to be the lead editor on that one because he's the one with the contacts with Routledge. But we already have been working with authors, again, literally all over the world, China, Africa, Europe. I don't know that we've got anyone in South America. There is someone in Mexico. I think there's someone in Canada. I just kind of going down the list, and I don't remember everyone because it's 50 people that I would have to remember. But I think it's going to be a really exciting book because it's going to give us an even more global perspective on this idea of transnationalism, which is a big topic right now in historical studies of all sorts, but fairly new for journalists to be moving into. So I'm really excited to be part of opening up this conversation for our field.
But you also have another vein of research, which is the 19th century American press, and you sort of alluded to that earlier. Can you tell us a little bit more about the two books you're working on with Mary LaMonica at New Mexico State?
Sure. So Mary approached me a few years ago about doing a two-book series, one on the Western press during the Civil War and one on the Midwestern press, because most of the work that's been done on the Civil War press has been done primarily on the Northern press. A little more on the Southern in the last 20 years between myself and Ford Risley, who's at Pennsylvania State, and a few other people who've dared to go down the Confederate Avenue. We've found out a little bit more about the Southern press than has been known in the past. But nothing's been done literally. I mean, Mary and I are, and the people doing the chapters in that book, are literally writing the book on the Midwestern press. I'm sorry, on the Western press. That's the first one we're dealing with. And we're discovering kind of interesting things because it was a long way away from where the Civil War was actually happening. And so how did they get the news and what did they do with it once they got it? You know, at least in the North and the South, they were close enough to the battlefields they could send correspondents, or it was very common in the South to have men from your hometown who were serving in battles to write home to the newspaper and say, this is what happened to our unit. And that's how a lot of Southern newspapers got war news, because they didn't have the money to afford correspondence. But in the West, most of the men from the West who served took the places of those regulars who were called back East to take part in the Eastern and Western theaters in Virginia and Tennessee primarily. And so those men who went into the militia or into the military out West took the places in the forts that were dealing with the Indians out West. So they didn't see a lot of action besides Indian wars and conflict with Indians. So you didn't have people writing back about the big war story, which was the fighting going on in the East. So how did they get the news? And of course, you did have the Associated Press, but you didn't have telegraph lines that went everywhere in the West. So you couldn't necessarily have subscribed to the Associated Press, even though it existed. So how'd the news get there? So we looked at that. We looked at military reporting. We looked at domestic reporting. I'm trying to remember what all the chapters are now. I did the statistical analysis to find out who were these people who were editing the newspapers, what were their characteristics and that sort of thing. Because I kind of follow in a line of researchers that I would say is headed by a fellow by the name of David Nord that looks at communities of journalism, which looks at readers and editors and how do they build a news community together. And so that's kind of what my contribution was to this. So we are looking at that. We're about to wrap that book up. We're doing the last edits of it right now. And then we do the Midwestern Press. I would say probably we know more about the Ohio Press. We've seen a lot of writing about the newspapers, particularly in Cincinnati. And I think part of that was because Sylvanus Cadwallader, who started out at one of the Cincinnati newspapers, ended up being the, I'm going to call him the bureau chief for the New York Herald coverage in Virginia and became a very famous journalist as a result. So we know a little bit more about Cincinnati because of Sylvanus Cadwallader, but we just don't know much about what got reported in Wisconsin or Minneapolis, but we know that those states sent huge numbers of men to fight in the Civil War. So I'm really looking forward to getting into the Midwestern book, but that's next.
There's some incredible characters from the Midwest. Brick Pomeroy from Wisconsin, who basically said it would have been okay if somebody assassinated Lincoln, and then he had to pay a terrible price when that actually happened. The newspaper in Chicago that Wilbur F. Story ran, the Chicago Times, he was sensational before Hearst or Pulitzer, really a fascinating guy. And just in general, the Midwest was much more sort of chaotic and kind of all over the place politically in ways that I think will surprise people.
I think you're right. I mean, I know you certainly know about that because you've done the book on Milo Haskell and his issues with the Copperhead Press and
Indiana. Well, anyway, and of course, Reed Smith down here at Georgia Southern did a wonderful book on the Columbus, Ohio newspapers and their tremendous friction during the war. Samuel F. Mederi was a Copperhead and a great journalist, as was Story. In fact, one of the things people don't know is that the Times, the Chicago Times, was a much bigger paper than the Tribune, but Joseph Medill, who the Northwestern Journalism School is named after, was a big supporter of Lincoln, and the Tribune really took off after the war. Well, this show's about you, not me. Is there anything else you want to tell us about your sort of contemporary research, what you're working on now, or is that pretty much everything?
I think that's just about everything that is boiling right now. There are some long-term projects. I want to get back to Marr. I want to get back to one of his comrades in leading that 1848 revolution in Ireland, a fellow by the name of John Mitchell, who is controversial both here in the United States and in Ireland because there is some question as to whether he was a slavery supporter or not. He certainly was a supporter of the Confederacy. He left New York and came south before the Civil War, but not much before. He got into a big controversy with one of O'Connell's second-in-commands over the issue of slavery because he wrote to Mitchell and told him that he needed to make sure to condemn slavery in his newspaper. And Mitchell basically said, I'm going to do what I want to in my newspaper. And from the way I read Mitchell, he opposed abolition. And part of what I'm trying to figure out is, does that mean he supported slavery? He never owned slaves, and he could have if he had wanted to. And so one of the big questions I want to get in with him is opposing abolition the same thing as approving slavery? But I also found him a very interesting journalist in the Confederate period because he started out working for the newspaper that supported Jefferson Davis, and then he decided Jefferson Davis's policies were harming the Confederacy, and Davis was about the worst thing that could have ever happened to the president, I'm sorry, to the Confederacy. And so he went to work for the opposition newspaper in Richmond and did his best to pull Davis down in every way possible, so much so that he eventually had to leave the Confederacy and go to France and reported for some Irish newspapers and Fenian newspapers in France for a few years. But he also gave two sons to the Confederacy who were killed during the war. His third son, who would end up being a mayor of New York City, lost an arm so he sacrificed a lot. No one has ever written a biography of him as a journalist. All of the biographies of him have been as revolutionaries. So that's a long-term project that I kind of am looking forward to getting into at some point.
Yeah, I think the 1848 revolutions in Europe are something that are really sort of underappreciated and undertaught probably in the United States, but they had a huge effect, I think, on the Civil War.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you see that even in 1860, they're still talking about the 1848 wars, particularly in Poland. I'm not sure why Poland made such a big impression in the United States, but that's what I see when I'm reading the newspapers is Poland this, Poland that. You know, it's fascinating. So definitely some transnational flows there to that story, too.
Well, thank you, Dr. Debbie Van Tuyl, for talking to us today. It's been a pure joy to listen to you talk about journalism history. This has been The Research Report, a production of the Department of Communication at Augusta University. The producer of our show is one of our students, Lauren Salzman. The views are those of the guest and the moderator, and not of Augusta University. We will have another one of these broadcasts soon. And thank you again, Debbie, and have a good day.
Thank you.